The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and/or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and today I'll be reading from the June 11th, 2018 edition of the New Yorker magazine. I'll start today with a postscript, Philip Roth, who took its last breath on May 22nd, 2018. The meaning of life is that it stops. Especially in his later years, Philip Roth often quoted this remark, contributed to Kafka, and it was hard not to think of it when the news came that his heart had given out. He lived to be 85, but he had little expectation of making it much past 70. Over the years, there had been stretches of depression, surgeries on his back and spine, a quintuple bypass, and 16 cardiac stents, which must be some kind of American League record. By the time Roth was in his 70s, he would open his eyes in the morning and experience a moment of ecstatic surprise. He had pulled it off again, stolen another taste of being alive, a self conscious of the beautiful and chaotic world. Roth's vitality never dwindled, particularly on the page. The propulsive force that first announced itself in the late 50s with Defender of the Faith, Eli the Fanatic, and Goodbye Columbus persisted for more than half a century, to the last elegiac description of a javelin thrower in Nemesis, his career-closing novella. In interviews and public appearances, Roth could be slightly grand, ending an observation with an Anglo-ish, "Do you know?" Talking about the indigenous American berserk, he tamped down his more antic side, as if to stand apart from the madness. But released from obligation, he could easily flip a switch and be once more the wiseacre of Weequahic. He was in competition with the best in American fiction, with Melville, James, Wharton, Hemingway, Faulkner, Cather, Ellison, Bellow, Morrison. But he was funnier, more spontaneous than any of them. Recently, when I asked him about what he thought of Bob Dylan's Nobel Prize, he said, "It's okay, but next year I hope Peter, Paul, and Mary get it." Most creative careers follow a familiar arc, the apprentice work, the burst of originality, the self-imitation, and finally, the tailing off. Had Roth's creative career reached its pinnacle at the typical point, his achievements would have included Goodbye Columbus, Portnoy's Complaint, The Ghostwriter, and The Counterlife. But then Roth, having faced the crises of a failed marriage and a barrage of illnesses, redoubled his sense of discipline and set himself free. He became a monk of fiction. Living alone in the woods, he spent his days and many of his nights trained on the sentence, the page, the problem of the novel at hand. Month after month, at a standing desk, he went about exploring American history, American pastoral, I Married a Communist, The Human Stain, The Plot Against America, and always the miracles, the hypocrisies, the mistakes, the strangeness of being alive while facing the inevitable massacre of aging. "I work. I'm on call," he told me in the midst of this creative ferment. "I'm like a doctor, and it's an emergency room. and I'm the emergency. Roth's concentration on the task was absolute. When a friend left him with a kitten, he couldn't endure the distraction of having to provide food and attention. I had to ask my friend to take it back, he recalled. I once asked him if he took a week off or a vacation. I went to the Met and saw a big show they had, he told me. It was wonderful. I went back the next day. Great. But what was I supposed to do next? Go a third time? So I started writing again. Roth kept a little yellow note near his desk. It read, "No optional striving. No panels, no speeches, no all-expenses-paid trips to the festival in Sydney or Cartagena. The work was murder, and the work was reward." Roth said he was never happier, never felt more liberated than when he was working on his favorite of his novels, Sabbath's Theater. Then, in 2010, at the age of 77, Roth did something utterly unexpected. He retired. He adored Saul Bellow, adored the work and the man. But he thought that Bellow had made a mistake by continuing to write and publish even as his mental acuity waned. Roth read his own work, the whole of it, and determined that he was done. Quoting Joe Lewis, he said, "I did the best I could with what I had." And in the last 8 years of his life, Roth, living mostly in his apartment near the Hayden Planetarium, gave himself the rest he had earned. He spent more time with friends. He read volumes of American and European history. He went to chamber music concerts. He watched baseball and old movies. He appointed a biographer, Blake Bailey, and gave him what he needed to do the job. With his competitiveness long faded, he became a reader and a booster of younger writers. Teju Cole, Nicole Krauss, Zadie Smith, Lisa Halliday, and he waited. He had had his portion, and then some. As he put it in The Dying Animal, "You tasted it. Isn't that enough?" This essay was written by David Remnick. And now, from the fiction section, a short story entitled Silver Tiger by Liu Yang. I lived with my deaf granny from a very young age and was sent to be with my mother and my father only on feast days and for memorials. Behind Granny's house was a deep well pond, and it was in that well pond that I first saw the silver tiger. Much of what I'm going to tell you is inextricably bound up with that silver tiger. In physical form, the silver tiger's paws flexed and sprang as it stepped nimbly through the thickets of my childhood memory, an awe-inspiring presence. I have to begin this with the well ponds. Well ponds are an ancient form of water storage, still in use in the countryside around Wuntang Town. As the name implies, they are shaped like pools, but are well-like in depth. Well ponds must be kept clean. Women are strictly forbidden to scrub chamber pots or wash their undergarments in them. Most well ponds are no more than a dozen meters across, sufficient for only the two or three households that neighbor them. Sometimes they are pressed into service to extinguish fires that break out in nearby grass heaps and pigsties. They say Deaf Granny's well pond came about in the following way. For many years, a stream had passed by her house. Then an abrupt decision was made to fill it in and turn it into a narrow belt of good cropland. But Deaf Granny has always been stubborn, and she wouldn't go along with the plan, no matter how much her neighbors cajoled and cursed. So, when the villagers filled in the stream, A section a dozen meters long was left behind her house, and she hired some men. The men from outside the village worked to deepen it. They dug to the depth of a bamboo pole. The water turned a dark, dark green, and it became one more of the area's many well ponds. The villagers called this the Sun Family Well Pond. But since when was Granny named Sun? When I was small, that well pond was strictly off limits to me. Deaf Granny always said that water figured in my fate, and she feared that if I fell into the pond, there'd be no saving me. But how I yearned for the world of the well pond. There was another boy in the village, a year older than me, named Dong. Once he caught a very small turtle and brought it to show me. It was a lovely little turtle. When you turned it over, it would stretch out its heads and its legs and wave them helplessly in the air. It worked itself into a little frenzy, but couldn't right itself. We summoned a girl from the village to come and play with us. Her name was Juan. She was my age. Juan's hair was thin and yellowing, and tied at the crown of her head in what they called a Josh stick braid. Juan leaned close to Dong and asked enviously, "A turtle! How'd you catch it, Dong?" Dong said loftily, "I caught it in a well pond." I asked, "Are there more?" He tossed his head. "Sure, plenty more. When I caught this one, he was covered in black mud. I put him in a brass bowl and washed him clean. See how clean he is?" "How do you know there are more?" I asked. "Well, I don't know," he said, pushing Juan's hand away from the turtle. "My mother told me." Then Juan said, "I'll bet it wasn't Dong who caught it at all. Aunt Ma got it for him." Aunt Ma was Dong's mother. We called her Ma, not because she was his mother, but because her family name was Ma. Aunt Ma was the sturdiest woman in the village, more powerful than a man. In the depths of winter, I'd see her pass my window in the early morning. She was sure to be carrying a big bamboo basket and a heavy net over her shoulder, the bamboo handle shuddering with each step. Granny told me that the net was full of little fish and shrimp she'd caught at the river fork by the village. Catching a turtle in a well pond would be child's play for Aunt Ma. So I believed what Juan said. But Dong, his pride wounded, was furious. He snatched up the turtle, gave us a nasty look, and left. From then on, I was even more fascinated by the world of the well pond. When I thought of all the little turtles concealed within the dark green water, I couldn't sit still. Many times I decided to sneak off by myself and take a look. Many times I made it as far as the vegetable patch behind the house, just a few steps from the well pond. And many times Deaf Granny dragged me by the ear back into the smoke-wreathed kitchen. She would point at the steaming pot and say, "Ah, Yang, my good grandson, I've boiled a pot of pork for you. If you fall into the well pond and drown, you'll never get to taste it." For a stretch of time that winter, the weather was unusually clear and warm. Granny decided to have someone trim the branches of the dozen willows that stood around the well pond. She asked hunchbacked Fifth Uncle from the village to help. Fifth Uncle was the most honest man in the village. He was only 30, but his back was bent like that of a 60-year-old. Granny chose him because he worked hard and kept silent. "And what's more," she said, "he's good in the water. Ah, Yang can go down by the well pond to play, and even if he falls in, there's no call to worry." And so I dressed in a big quilted jacket and a cotton hat and followed Fifth Uncle to the well pond. I'd been yearning to explore. Behind us, Granny warned, "Fifth Uncle, don't let Ah Yang play in the water." When we reached the well pond's edge, the sunlight was floating clean and bright on its surface. Sure enough, hunchbacked Fifth Uncle worked hard and silently. He climbed one of the old willows and got busy. I stood below, occasionally helping retrieve a dead branch that had fallen too far away. Standing there with branches in my hands was boring, so I looked up at Fifth Uncle and said, "Dong has a little turtle. It came from a well pond. Do you think there are more?" Straddling a fork of the tree, Fifth Uncle mumbled, "Sure, plenty more." "Why can't I see them then?" Fifth Uncle answered, "They're hiding under the water." After a while, Fifth Uncle climbed another tree. He moved quietly and deftly as he worked. He'd brought a big pair of black iron shears and a handsaw with a wooden handle, and as he employed each tool in turn, he gradually lost himself in the job. Ah Yang stood at the water's edge, dead stick in hand, watching more dead sticks and twigs falling gently from the tree like brown feathers. Ah Yang raised his head to look at Fifth Uncle in the tree, and it seemed as though the twigs were drifting down from inside his bent body. Fifth Uncle moved from one tree to the next, filled with the pleasure of labor. He hadn't the slightest inkling that, below him, Ah Yang had already met the water of his fate. He had fallen into the well pond. There were two aspects to what happened that day. One was Fifth Uncle's pleasure in his work. The other was Ah Yang's falling into the pond. You were focused on the former and so overlooked the latter. Even though, after the fact, you may be able to comb through your memories of the scene and recover the second aspect, the clouding of those memories, like damage to an old photograph, is something you are powerless to prevent. The best you can do is to note that the banks of well ponds are often steep, and in the winter, when the weeds have withered, the well ponds are like nothing so much as enormous, irregular buckets. And the light was good that day, and the dark green water of the well pond hid so many turtles. And a patch of frozen earth beneath Ah Yang's feet had melted just enough to loosen. And the smallest and lightest of the falling twigs just happened to brush his eyebrows and lashes. A certain principle will occur to you. Though the well pond seems small to an adult, merely an oversized oval bathtub, to Ah Yang it is an ocean, an abyss. Ah Yang is the one who is speaking now. Ah Yang is the one who wrote all the words you see here. Ah Yang wanted so much to catch a turtle, shrouded in green. Ah Yang wanted to make a hole in its shell and tie it with a string to a willow root at the willow's edge, at the water's edge. Fifth Uncle's absorption in his work meant that my fall into the well pond went smoothly. There was nothing to hinder my arrival at the water's surface. But there, on the sunny face of the water, I met with an unexpected setback that halted my progress. I did not, in fact, fall all the way into the well pond. I was rejected at the water's surface. Wearing my thick, quilted coat and cotton hat, holding a willow stitch in my hand, I lay on top of the water. It was as if a strong membrane were stretched tightly across the Soon family well pond, reluctant to give way beneath me. This was the water of my fate. The water of my fate held firm and unbroken beneath me until a cry rang out from someone passing by. Later, Aunt Ma would always say to others and said to Ah Yang, "If I hadn't seen him and given a shout that day, the child would have drowned for sure." She also said, "The banks of the Sun family well pond are so steep, a crab couldn't crawl out." Aunt Ma was a sturdy woman. Granny was right to call her coarse. Her voice was as coarse as the rest of her. She couldn't have known that her shout would consign Ah Yang to such long years of hardship and regret. That was the first time I saw a silver tiger. As it happened, I lay on the water's surface for only an instant, but in that instant I saw the most essential silver tiger. What a beautiful tiger it was. It was not an animal of this world, made of flesh and bone and fur. It was only a shadow filled with silver. Or you could say it was a silver body, silver fur, silver motion, silver pride, a silver riddle. I lay on the water of the well pond and watched the silver tiger approach from the air above me, drawing closer to my face. The sunlight passing through it became variegated and dazzling, dancing, enchanting. Terrified and yet consoled, I closed my eyes. I felt as if the silver tiger were tenderly swallowing me whole. I felt as if it had already swallowed me into its belly. I felt that I was slowly becoming the silver tiger. Things went on in this way. The transformations were continuous, endless. I remember the last thing I saw, a silver tiger in the process of swallowing the self-same silver tiger. The child on the surface of the well pond had disappeared completely, as though he had never existed. Just as Granny said, Ah Yang had always been a sickly and unlucky child. The blind fortune teller had seen this in the hour of his birth. The fortune teller could not see faces, but he could see heaven's will. What's more, he had now found his way unerringly into Granny's house, approaching step by step from a very great distance. He sat on a wooden bench in the kitchen and said, This child was a nobleman in a former life. Nobles may come calling, but they do not linger. In this child's fate, there is death by water, by metal, by earth, and by wood. There is no death by fire. Deaf Granny kept a tight hold on my right ear, as though I were a rabbit on the verge of bounding off. She pinched my ear and asked the fortune teller, Tell us, what can break his curse? The fortune teller lowered his head and stayed that way for a long time, and then finally said, By the time he is nine, this child's roots will be firm. Keep him alive until he's nine. Once he's rooted, there'll be nothing to fear. As Aunt Ma passed beneath the trees, she saw me lying on the surface of the well pond, shimmering, about to sink. She gave a cry, and then pulled me from the well pond with her own rough hands. Fifth Uncle was already scrambling down from the tree. Aunt Ma raised my soaking body up high and placed me on Fifth Uncle's bowed back. Ah, Yang, she said later, you look just like a hand towel scooped out of a wash basin, all flowing with water. After my rescue from the well pond, I met with another of my childhood misfortunes. This particular misfortune was, from start to finish, confined to my immature manhood. I was unable to pee properly, no matter how hard I tried. Some calamity had beset my member. Something or other was blocking it. All day long, I was desperate to pee. Yet, in the course of 3 days, I managed no more than a few thimblefuls. I was very young to suffer such pain. Tears in my eyes, I sought out Dong and Juan and joined in the game they were playing with an iron shovel. I said to Dong, I can't pee, and it hurts. Dong pointed at the shovel and said, We'll sharpen it good and cut off your penis. Then it won't hurt. Bah, I said, you can cut off your own. I turned my back on him and said to Juan, I can't pee. It hurts. Juan said, let me look. I hastily pulled my split pants closed, concealing my suffering manhood. Juan became upset. You're useless, she said. Even the well pond water spirits don't want you. My eyes reddening, I snapped back. Stupid Juan, who said that? Aunt Ma. Aunt Ma said it. Are you going to tangle with her? deaf granny believed that when Ah Yang fell into the well pond, he had a fright that had settled inside his body and stopped him up. She burned several stacks of paper money by the old willow stump at the well pond. As the money burned, she called loudly, "Yang, child, come home to eat. Your granny's cooking meat." To this day, I wonder if part of my soul really did get lost in the green depths of the Sun family well pond. Each bill that Granny burned was cut with a beautiful crescent moon design. Father took me to the hospital in Runtang Town, which was next door to a farm tool factory. He carried me through a heavily curtained doorway and into a dim room. It looked to me like the changing room of a decrepit public bath. The whitewashed walls were marked with messy purple streaks. Someone brought in a hot water bottle. The bottle was green and very full. Father pressed it to my groin and my member. At first it burned, but after a while it felt nice and warm. "You'll be fine if we just warm you up," Father said. I didn't believe him for a second. I heard a distinct sound of farm tools rattling and banging next door. I guessed that it was the sound of an iron hoe striking a pair of shears. I was afraid that the people at the hospital might use those farm tools on me. Then a skinny man with a yellowish face came in. He wasn't wearing a white gown. Father bowed to him and asked, "Our turn, doctor?" The next room was also dim. A high, narrow iron bed was pushed against one wall. Father put me on the bed, which was covered with tattered grass mats. I suspected that the holes in the mats had been made by people kicking their heels. Father pressed his hand to my forehead and seemed at a loss. The hot water bottle on my groin had suddenly felt cold. My life before the age of 9 was precarious, as if it were a drifting thing that refused to come to rest in my body. My ghastly cries in that hospital disturbed the peace of half the residents of Runtang Town. At that young age, I knew what it was to curse wildly in an iron hospital bed, to hurl profanities at people who roughly held my limbs. Before the age of 9, I was pressed down on a bed and made to undergo an operation I scarcely dare to recall now. In later days, when I had become an eminent intellectual in Luoqing, I told the story of this suffering to some close female friends and noted their expressions of rapt fascination. But they weren't like Juan, I thought. They would never say, "Let me look." Many people that night tried to steal a glimpse through the window. They were child laborers from the farm tool factory. These spies at the window told me later that my operation, performed without anesthesia, had been truly horrifying to watch, worse than a woman in childbirth. They heard the discussion between the skinny doctor and my father. The doctor asked, "Should we anesthetize him?" And my father said, "No, it could damage his brain." The doctor hesitated. "He may not be able to stand it otherwise." My father answered, "Stupidity may kill you, but pain never has." The skinny doctor gave a few dry coughs and rubbed his hands together. "Fine. Then you'll have to help us hold him down, his arms." He called in another rough-faced man to hold my legs. From a pocket, he produced a length of unusual wire. It was more than a foot long, and one end was flattened and curved. It looked like an oversized ear pick. He weighed it, gleaming in his hand, and he said, "All right. Have you got a hold on him?" The spies at the window could tell you the next part in great detail. They could tell you how the skinny doctor reached out a yellow hand and lightly fingered Ah Yang's penis, then carefully and deftly inserted the wire into it. Then Ah Yang, in pain, was like a fish in a frying pan. His belly arched, bucked, twisted. Then his limbs were pressed tightly to the bed by his father and the other man. Then, unable to move, he began to cry and curse. And then the sound he made was almost inhuman. Then great quantities of liquid came flowing from his member, a mixture of piss and blood. Then the mat beneath him was soaked and dyed red, and then his head struck the iron bed with a bang. Then he could make no further sound. Then the piss and blood continued to pour from him, flowing to the edge of the bed, dripping to the floor. And then Ah Yang became limp and shriveled as though sleeping. When I had grown up, my father told me severely, "We didn't use anesthesia in order to preserve your wits." I was silent, though I thought that wits were good for little but making one more sensitive to pain. To this day, on my bookshelf, there stands an elegant little bottle with two objects visible inside. One is a tuft of hair cut from my head when I was a year old. The other is a round stone the size of a pea. The stone in the bottle was plucked from my body by the skinny doctor. There are times when I wonder how an object even rounder and smoother than a pea could have caused me so much pain. When the spies outside the window did not see, what the spies outside the window did not see was the silver tiger. I saw it. In the extremity of my agony, I saw the silver tiger again. It was a different silver tiger. Or it was the same silver tiger, but it had changed its nature. The one on the surface of the pond had been gentle and bright. The one under the iron hospital bed was fierce and keen. The silver tiger stuck its head out from the shadows under the bed and opened its huge and shapeless mouth, biting down on my right ankle. I felt its teeth sinking deep into bone and sinew. I felt it tearing through the connection between me and the bed with an obscure strength. I felt it trying to drag me into true darkness. I sought to grip the railings of the bed. I even became grateful for the hands that held my four limbs tight. I hoped for a still heavier, more heartless pressure to hold me fast to the hospital bed. I didn't want to be dragged away. "Help me," I said. "It wants to carry me away." No, not one person, inside or outside the room, heard what I said. The operation had reached its climax, and they had no attention to spare. My hands grew tired from gripping the railing, but they never loosened their hold. In fact, I bled from two places during that operation. Ah Yang's member was bleeding. Ah Yang's ankle was also bleeding. One kind of pain there, another kind of pain here. Can I speak of it this way? I just want you to understand that the silver tiger was truly there. It has come many times. I bear the marks of its teeth to this day. I fought the silver tiger for 3 days and three nights. During those 3 days and nights, I lost all awareness of anything else in the hospital. The iron bed was the arena of the battle, where I resisted the tiger with all my might and was eventually victorious. On the morning of the fifth day, Fifth Uncle arrived and carried me out of the hospital on his hunchback. I lay across his back and saw the wide open fields outside the hospital. I felt a cold wind blowing from the north, cooling my swollen cheeks. I lay on Fifth's uncle's back as we passed field after field of cold earth and wheat stubble until we were back at the village. I saw sparrows flying out from under the eaves of the buildings in little flocks and groups, the same as they always had. Deaf Granny stood beneath the eaves, waving to me from a distance. She'd stood there waiting for 3 days and three nights. She asked everyone returning from Rungtang Town about me. She asked only one question. "Did Ah Yang cry?" I was brought to my granny, draped over Fifth Uncle's back. I said in her ear, "Granny, Ah Yang didn't cry. Ah Yang's back now." My voice sounded very small and soft to me. I watched as my granny suddenly covered her eyes and began sobbing. She forgot to cover her mouth. Her mouth was very old and very empty, and it opened, huge and round, before me. It wasn't a nice mouth to see at all. In later days, when I was an intellectual in Luokjing, I looked for a way to write a record of the thatched house where I lived as a child with my deaf granny. A small and honest record. If you visit the countryside around Rongtang Town, you won't see any such lovely thatched houses now. The walls of the houses were 2 feet thick and made of piled earth, or rather of pounded earth. The man who built the house would pile on some mud, then heft a great club and pound down on it. Between the piling and the pounding, a single wall took days to complete. I loved the sound of the club smacking the wet earth. That sound signified the countryside to me. The roof was made of a plaited reed mat, thatched with wheat stalks set inside from the autumn harvest. They were piled on thickly and carefully. The builder used a flat block to pat one end of each straw bundle until it was even, and then trimmed the other end with shears and carefully plucked out the weeds and the broken fragments. Every stalk of the roof thatching was in perfect order, and the straw kept its fresh yellow luster for 6 months or more. I remember the special care the builder took with the shaping of the eaves, never satisfied with his work. And when it was done, Deaf Granny's thatched house put all the other houses to shame. It had one door and one small window, which was in the kitchen. 2 loquat trees sprouted outside that window, and by the time I was 9 years old, they had quietly grown tall and luxurious, taller even than the eaves of the house. I am speaking of an empty thatched house. As everyone knows, when Deaf Granny died, she was buried in the vegetable plot outside the house. I, on the other hand, lived past the age of 9 and eventually boarded a train and went to Luoqing and established a home. So, in fact, what I'm speaking of is an empty house. There's no one inside it. Granny and I both left it, though I see now that we left it in different ways. Faced with an empty, thatched house, I am uneasy. I must fill its emptiness with things that have no form of their own. Perhaps the fragrance of food would serve. Perhaps the fragrance of boiled pork and corn cakes. Before my 9th year, I became ill, or fell into water, or fell from a tall peach or willow tree. Every time I was wounded or struck or narrowly escaped death, the kitchen of the thatched house would be suffused with the smell of good things to eat. I got to eat my granny's boiled pork nearly every year. Her handmade corn cakes were tender and delicious, one side seared brown, the other a pale yellow. The marks of her hands on the cake's surface were movingly clear. On those fragrant days, the little girl Wan would always come early to play and stay until it was time to eat. My granny would console me. "We should all share, Ah Yang." She also said to me, "If Wan catches sight of you while you're eating a corn cake, you must share it with her. Whenever anyone sees you eating, you have to share with that person." She explained that food would turn sour if other people stared at it for too long and would eventually give you a bellyache. I'm quite certain that no one was watching the last time Granny made corn cakes. She lingered in the kitchen, seemingly unwilling to come out. She spent the whole day inside, all day, from morning till night. The stove smoke spiraled up from the kitchen. That day, Granny made 561 corn cakes. Each one of them was delicious, better than any she'd ever made. for having denied me anesthesia during the operation, for having added to my suffering, my father made a meager gesture of repentance. From Rongtang Town, he brought me a small copper gong the size of an ox's hoof print, along with a mallet made from a bamboo chopstick, the thick end tightly wrapped in rags. He presented me with the gong and the mallet, saying, "Ah Yang, if you ever feel any pain, you just strike this gong as hard as you can." I asked why I would do that. Father answered, "If you strike the gong, I'll hear it, and I'll come and take you to the hospital." I just looked at the little copper gong, not daring to touch it. But that day, after she had made the corn cakes, Granny suddenly said to me, "Ah Yang, go into the village at noon tomorrow and strike your gong." I asked, "What for?" And Granny rubbed my ear and said, "Just do as you're told." Behind the thatched house was the vegetable plot, and beyond that was the well pond. In front of the house there were wheat fields, field after field. In winter, there were no haricote beans outside the house. You couldn't find them if you tried. Everything around the thatched house changed with the seasons. What should have been there in spring was there in spring. What should have been there in summer was there in summer. What should have been there in fall was there in fall. What shouldn't have been there in winter was not there in winter. Thus, there were no white and purple beans. By the time I was 9, my roots were firm. In the year I was 9, Deaf Granny left me. It was some kind of flux. She nearly died of the shame. She soiled her own clothes and could never get them clean. Everyone said that when she was younger, she'd been so clean, so appealing, and they were quite right. She couldn't stand what she'd become, and in the last few days, I'd often hear her talking to herself, saying, "I'm filthy. I ought to be dead." The sun went down, setting on a distant village. Deaf Granny brought out her corn cakes, making delivery after delivery to everyone in the village. She walked lightly, at a steady pace. Her feet barely touched the earth as she delivered a last gift to everyone. That whole night, the fragrance of corn cakes drifted through the village. Perhaps it was that heavy scent that kept me awake that night. Granny patted my cotton quilt, saying, "Sleep." I didn't want to make her angry. I pretended to be asleep. But in the midst of my childhood darkness, my ears could catch the slightest sound and my eyes saw all moving objects. I knew that the silver tiger had come from somewhere outside the village. This silver tiger was different. Or perhaps it was the same silver tiger and had yet again changed its nature. Its movements were slow and dogged as it approached. It stood outside the door of the thatched house like an old stone bench, cold and heavy. Those times that I saw the silver tiger, I didn't know that it was a tiger, nor did I understand its color, its light. The phrase "silver tiger" is something I hit on only later, when I was older. A term I used to describe the experiences of my youth. Silver tiger was one of the blessings granted to me by 17 years of education. It is what's known as a compound phrase. And as a compound phrase, it joins with other words and phrases to enrich my speech. Meanwhile, as a visual image, it illuminates the realm of my experience. Deaf Granny leaned against the loquat tree to the left of the window, stepped on a couple of broken bricks that had fallen from the chimney, and pulled herself with difficulty onto the back of the silver tiger. The tiger was so docile, it seemed even to bow its head and kneel. And I shouted, "Granny, don't go. You can't let it take you away. Don't go. Don't let it take you away." I shouted and continued shouting until daybreak. At noon the next day, I went to the village to ring my gong. I ran all through the village, ringing the gong as I went. The faster I ran, the louder I rang it, and the louder I rang it, the faster I ran, and I was fast, and I was loud, and I was nearly mad. I wanted so much to stop, to have Fifth Uncle take me to my mother and my father. I wanted to lie across his hunchback and bid farewell to Dong, Aunt Ma, and the little girl Juan, who would be following behind me. "Don't let me keep you," I would say. "Go on back." And now, from the current cinema section, a review entitled Galactic Entanglements, Solo, A Star Wars Story, and How to Talk to Girls at Parties, by Anthony Lane. It has been 5 whole months since the last Star Wars movie, and the wait has been intolerable. Our patience has been sorely tried, and to test its further would constitute a gross violation of our civil rights. No citizen should be denied his or her dose of galactic hyperdrive. Curb that prerogative, and the Supreme Court would have something to say on the matter. Luckily, just as tempers were starting to flare, Solo, A Star Wars Story, has arrived to save the day. The hero is Han Solo, and he is played by Alden Ehrenreich, who, aside from the fact that he looks, talks, walks, grins, and growls in a manner that bears no relation whatsoever to Harrison Ford, is perfect for the part. As for the plot, it can best be summarized as a portrait of the pilot as a young jock. We first encounter Solo on the cruddy planet of Corellia, where he pilfers and hustles for a living, trying not to antagonize Lady Proxima, voiced by Linda Hunt, or, as an on-screen title ungallantly calls her, the foul Lady Proxima. I know she's a giant worm in a pond, but there's no need to be rude, and since when did a movie decry its characters before they're even introduced? Mind you, if The Empire Strikes Back from 1980 had presented us with the irritating Yoda, we might have paused before munching on his nuggets of gristly wisdom. Solo flees Corellia, leaving behind Kira, played by Emilia Clarke, for whom he has the hots, or to judge by his expression, the tepids. We join him 3 years later, and if I told you that he's used this valuable time to finish a PhD in marine biology or gender studies, I would be paltering with the truth. Instead, he's been soldiering, an honorable calling, but one that he now sloughs off, choosing a ragged life of crime in the company of Beckett, played by Woody Harrelson, and Val, played by Thandi Newton. The highlight for Solo is a prolonged bout of mud wrestling, his vast and matted opponent being none other than Chewbacca, played by Junis Suotamo. So that's how they met. What cements their union is the news that Solo can speak, or at any rate gurgle, the language of the Wookiees, though it must be said that the patois is less charming on the human tongue. Han may be murmuring endearments, but he sounds like someone who has dined on unrefrigerated shrimp and is about to suffer the consequences. Chewie, I think, this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship. The film is written by Lawrence Kasdan, whose credits include The Empire Strikes Back and Raiders of the Lost Ark. For Solo, he has teamed up with his son Jonathan, and one thing I like about the result And also, I suspect, the thing that will exasperate the more pious fans of the franchise is how often it feels nudged by the spirit, not of Star Wars, but of Indiana Jones. There is a heist aboard a speeding train on an elevated mountain track that has nothing to do with outer space and plenty to do with avoiding mortal peril by a whisker. Precisely the sort of rampant gamble that Dr. Jones used to enjoy. Admittedly, Beckett, Solo, and the gang are stealing a load of coaxium, one of those precious elements unique to cinema, which might as well be labeled MacGuffinium, rather than Nazi gold or legendary jewels. But it's the swagger of the larceny that counts. I half expected Solo to crack a whip. In short, let us give thanks for all that is absent from this film. No monkish Jedis robed in wraparound brown, no superannuated Skywalker marooned on his little island rock, no windy convenings of Imperial councils, and not a single mention of the Force. Not once is Solo solemnly told to try feeling instead of thinking. Good advice if you're having a massage, but worse than useless for anyone hoping to operate complex machinery. Needless to say, Solo still pays its respects to movies past. Viewers may experience a warm trickle of nostalgia as they hear John Williams' original score rising softly to greet the Millennium Falcon, dusty and battered, and almost certainly requiring new brake pads, but still the real deal. If only the scene weren't such a blatant retread of Skyfall, in which 007 opens a garage door and reveals an Aston Martin DB5, as seen in Goldfinger in 1964, to the sultry accompaniment of a Bondian chord sequence on the soundtrack. Nothing like the old tunes to get an audience on your side. The Falcon belongs at first to Lando Calrissian, played by Donald Glover, part smuggler, part dandy, and the only figure who allows himself time to relax, not least in the unrushed delivery of his dialogue. "Everything you heard about me," he says with a sly hesitation, "is true." While uttering the line, he even holds out his tumbler of booze for a refill. Glover is on a roll right now. His music video for This Is America, with its four-minute blend of the ludic and the apocalyptic, is the most startling visual product of the year, and Solo pales and shrinks beside it. Yet Glover's Lando does supply a modicum of cool, a substance, let's face it, that is baffingly hard to unearth in the saga of Star Wars. So who made this film? Directed by Ron Howard, we read in the credits, but it was not until midway through production or later that he took control. Until then, the tale was driven by Christopher Miller and Phil Lord, who, having made our eyeballs bubble and pop with The Lego Movie in 2014, were presumably hired to import a similar zest to the shenanigans of Han. Whether they were relieved of their duty by decree of Lucasfilm and Walt Disney Studios for having disobeyed orders, for becoming, in effect, a two-man rebel alliance, lampooning the genre that they were meant to sustain. We may never know, but biting the hand that feeds you in a billion-dollar business is asking for trouble. Even nibbling on its pinky is a risk. It was Howard, therefore, the embodiment of a safe bet, who brought the movie home. How keenly you respond to it will depend on how tempted you are by the salad days of Solo. Personally, I preferred him in The Force Awakens in 2015, at the other end of his career. Visibly weary and fearful of having lost his greenness and his crunch, he was played once again by Harrison Ford, who, at the age of 73, retained the rueful and lopsided smile that had lightly mocked the whole Star Wars ethic from the start. The smile that said, "Can you believe this? Me neither. But we might as well have fun along the way." The reason for the name Solo, we are now informed, is that he always seemed to be on his own. Really? On the evidence of the new film, he should have been called Han Gregarious. Thousands of star systems to get lost in, and he barely gets a minute to himself. Fresh from a galaxy far away, not Solo's galaxy, but another one, is a band of colonists who assume the form of whichever species they happen to visit. Ergo, while staying on Earth, they resemble humans. In How to Talk to Girls at Parties, we meet a houseful of these space invaders, and in corporeal terms, their disguise cannot be faulted. Their fashion sense, though, is less discreet. Many of them favor all-over bodysuits in a lurid plastic material that clings like a second skin, a discomfiting tribute to the fetishistic sculptures of the British artist Alan Jones, which were mimicked by Stanley Kubrick in 1971 for the nastier segments of A Clockwork Orange. The mood in How to Talk to Girls at Parties, which is adapted from a short story by Neil Gaiman and directed by John Cameron Mitchell, is largely free of Kubrickian threat. Indeed, the most surprising aspect of the film is its suburban mildness, plus the hapless charm of its hero, Anne, played by Alex Sharp. He's a high school kid living in Croydon on the southern outskirts of London in 1977. The date matters, for punk is in full cry, and Anne gets his teenage kicks from going to see terrible but pleasingly clamorous bands. And then the aliens show up. The crashing of the otherworldly into the humdrum is the running gag on which this movie proceeds. It was prefigured in 1978 by one line in Douglas Adams' The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, when a two-headed stranger was introduced thus: "This is Zaphod Beeblebrox from Beetlegeist 5, you know, not bloody Martin Smith from Croydon." But it's not that funny, and Mitchell's humor is no less scattershot than it was in his debut film, Hedwig and the Angry Inch, in 2001. That raucous tale has since fared better on stage, and I suspect that the new work might well arrive at a similar fate. It's one of those movies which are so desperate to become cult viewing that they feel no obligation to be any good. Still, it does spring a few shocks in the casting department. Elle Fanning plays one colonist who befriends N. "Do more punk to me," she says, while Ruth Wilson is generally spooky as another. And hang on, who's that snarling matriarch of the club scene with the shock of spiky hair? Extraterrestrials can land anywhere, but Nicole Kidman in Croydon? Give me a break. Sounds like we've run out of time for today's broadcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed reading it. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Today's broadcast and all previous New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, triangleradingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. So long, everyone.